35 millimeters.
35.
Because I know that for the academy itself, you should talk directly.
There a kinship there, because, you know, Japanese are supposed to have a green thumb. In fact, you know, when I go to some of these parties and these hostesses that I'm meeting for the first time immediately, you know, want to get gardening advice from me. How do I? Little do they know, all I have to do is look at a plant and it promptly dies on me. I'm a disgrace to my race.
What is this interview coming up tonight?
What interview? I don't know what it is. I just got a letter from Entertainment Tonight. I did, you know, about an hour interview with for them. And they aired it, aired two different segments. They lifted pieces out of that conversation, and they've used it already. But apparently they're going to do something else, because...
Last year, the Film Society had a convention at the Sheraton in October, and we got about, 7 minutes of coverage on Entertainment Tonight the following evening. It was wonderful. This is the thing I was telling you about in October, which maybe we could talk about a little later. He and I are going to meet again this summer in Kansas City. He's the guest of honor at what is called the KCCon. And there's a convention
there.
Fans and, you know, all the whole thing out there in Kansas City.
Weekend of Bacchanalia.
Absolutely. Oh, I've been hearing about the Bacchanalia Suite or something like this.
Oh,
have
really?
You heard about this? Yes, it's been officially designated now. And there will be apparently...
The Bacchanalia Suite.
Yes. I don't know if that means that's where you will be, or where, or where Kay and Kathy will be. I'm not sure.
My.
Maybe a combination.
Yeah, it's really an incredible phenomenon, this thing called Star Trek conventions. They show start the old television episodes, 24 hours for a weekend. And you can walk in there at 3:30 in the evening, at night, and there'll be bodies lying around watching it. I am, you know, when I first saw one of those, I was absolutely flabbergasted. And then they have another ballroom filled with what we call hucksters, people who are selling memorabilia or trinkets that they've made related to Star Trek. And there are people that come with bagfuls of money and buy them. I saw model phaser gun that had some mechanical things in it where it flashed and it made tweeting sounds. Oh, you're recording already. That sold for $750. He was selling these phaser guns for $750, and I think he sold three during that weekend. It's absolutely incredible. I went to one of my earlier conventions. Jimmy Doohan brought one of his old scripts, and he auctioned that off, and that brought $150. I was just... A guess.
Have you kept some scripts yourself?
Particularly because what I had done with my scripts was, you know, after the episode was done, I just pile it up beside my desk. And when I'm paying bills and I need scratch paper to do some addition on, I would just tear out a sheet, you know, on the back side, do my addition, crumple it up, and drop it in the wastebasket. Or when my little baby niece or nephew would drop over, I'd give him a whole script and have him draw pictures for Uncle George on the backside, you know. So a small fortune passed through my wastebasket. And little did I realize that until that convention when Jimmy Doohan's script went for $150.
You must meet people at those conventions that know the scripts backwards and forwards.
Absolutely. They're like opera buffs who know the libretto.
Does
they can mouth the words.
Does that ever become embarrassing when they ask you questions that you say, oh, I don't know?
No. From the beginning, I preface my talks by saying, I just work there. The real experts, the authorities, are out there. You, out there, seated. You're the ones that are going to tell me what we did. And, you know, my memory isn't that good, and you've been watching it and studying it and as if, you know, you're preparing a master's thesis. So I just, you know, up front say, I'm not the expert. You're the authorities out there. And that gets me off the hook right off.
I thought we could stay with the fan phenomenon here for a while. What have been some of the more startling moments that you've encountered at some of these conventions or related activities?
Startling.
Or embarrassing.
Embarrassing.
Even, or
shocking. Or somehow, well, revealing. You know, it's very gratifying to have that kind of enthusiastic support and following. But you meet some people where, you know, you wish that Star Trek could have been a vehicle to broaden their lives, to give them a bigger vision of what life can be. Rather empty lives that they fill with this kind of almost a religious dedication to Star Trek, you know. And Star Trek really, if they really understood Star Trek, the message that we were trying to get out, and here, you know, sounding a little pompous and all that, but what we really were saying is life is a very brief journey, and it's what you do, how you fill in that period, that makes that span of time meaningful. And, you know, all that that's out there can just be there, and you know, it's like, you know, does the sound of the forest, the tree falling in the forest, exist if no one hears it? You know, it's all out there. You've got to get out there and experience it, involve yourself with it, try to derive some lessons out of the experiences that you have, and that way you enrich your life, and hopefully that'll have a ripple effect and enrich others. But, you know, that was the thing that I found a little sad. There are so many people that have such empty lives that they fill in such a narrow way by this kind of dedication to Star Trek. And then there are others that, you know, it's so exciting, the energy that they bring and the joy that they bring. And then, you know, for example, this guy, you know, obviously an entrepreneur who took the phaser gun idea and started reproducing them in really amazing. They're far better than the props that we use. You know, it had real weight. It had this mechanism, the beeping sound and so forth, and selling it for $750 and making a good, profit in that. So, you know, it attracted the entrepreneurial, and certainly these people that organize conventions have a good entrepreneurial streak in them, but also they have this wonderful social, you know, aspect to them. I suppose it's also political, too, in that sense. They've got to deal with a lot of people with their opinions and vested interests. So there are these exciting people, the activists, the doers, you know, that you come across. So it's the whole gamut, I suppose, on second thought, that you meet. You know, you really meet an exciting range of people in Star Trek. I guess I was most taken aback by, you know, some of the sadder people that are involved.
What are some of the things that you yourself have retained from your work on this series or in the films? I mean, do you ever take things with you, like props or anything like that?
Oh, you mean physical things? Mm-hmm. What I've gotten from this series is much more profound than just, you know, things.
Yeah.
I think Star Trek has changed my life in many, many respects. Certainly, I think my career is identified with that more than with any other work that I've done, although I'd like to think there are other works that I've done that I'm proud of and wish that I could be, you know, identified with.
Well, touching on that, too, I was wondering if the Japanese nationality had something to do originally with the character of Sulu. Or was it more accidental that Sulu was not necessarily intended to be any particular nationality in the first
place? No. Gene very consciously wanted a pluralistic look.
Yeah.
Earth people plus one Vulcan. So it was, I guess, galactically miscegenated as well. but he was very consciously trying to get that kind of look, that the spaceship Earth concept, that we're all in this together. You know, this was in the 1960s, mid-60s, when the civil rights issue was tearing the country apart. But somehow on television it wasn't being reflected at all. You know, it was a very bland kind of television. Star Trek, I think, was one of the few shows that dealt with the fact of the existence of a pluralistic society, and that we're inextricably interwoven with each other. Unless we work together, and unless we're able to work in concert to overcome a common, you know, adversary, then we're all jeopardized.
as far as your character goes, as distinguished from some of the other ones, quite apart from nationality. Now, Kay and Kathy told me to especially ask you about this. On the shows, you're famous for having lots of hobbies.
Mm.
Is this a reflection of you, your
I suppose so.
Are you
so.
A dabbler in things? Or
well,
what?
You know, I design my furniture. I'm, you know, I serve on the board of directors of the Transit District, of all things. You know, things. We run the bus line here, as well as we're planning a subway system underneath Wilshire Boulevard that you just came down. I'm involved in the political arena, and we're gearing up for Mayor Bradley's gubernatorial campaign. I'm heading up this fine arts committee to place works of fine arts in the public spaces that's being created by the revitalization.
But no exhibitions of swordsmanship anywhere.
I'm a dedicated runner. I competed in a 10K run. Came in 45 minutes and 27 seconds yesterday. And I'll be running in the Jimmy Stewart. That's a marathon next Sunday at Griffith Park. But actually, it's not a real marathon. It's a team marathon. So we all take 5 mile increments. There are five guys involved in the team. And the last guy runs the 6 miles that makes up the 26 mile.
Are you run. The last guy?
No. I'm going to be the third guy,
oh,
the middleman.
Well,
so I am, you know, I do have a wide range of interests, yeah. And I suppose that was a reflection of my character in some respects. But the other thing that I think was important with the character of Sulu with regard to his ethnicity, Sulu was obviously Asian by the fact that I played him, but he wasn't, boringly chauvinistic about his ethnicity. He was truly a 23rd century person because his name was kind of Asian, but not really identifiably anything.
Yes, it's such an interesting name, too.
Well, actually,
while we're at that.
Initially, the idea was a black actor playing that part. And it wasn't until after Gene interviewed me that he said, you know, why not? Yeah. And then after I started playing it, we discovered that there's a Sulu Seas east of the Philippines. So,
well,
serendipity.
Not?
But, you know, I spoke without an accent. I was a top-notch professional and certainly proud of my cultural heritage, but not totally ensconced in that. My character wasn't totally defined by that. For example, when I go into this swordsmanship thing, it's not a Japanese samurai sword. It's a French fencing foil. You know, he's really a man of the world. And his interests span all cultures. He's not, you know, defined. Whereas Chekhov was Russian and chauvinistically Russian and a little kind of, you know, unbelievable in that context. Where the 23rd century?
Well, I always wondered where Scotty got his
exactly,
accent.
And that accent.
And those where in the world?
the point that my character was making was made, I think, is made even by me today. You know, there's this wonderful and rich intercultural moving about now. I look Japanese. My great-grandfather would never have dreamed that his great-grandson would have an Anglo-Saxon first name attached to his surname. As a matter of fact, my father was an Anglophile and a lover of, you know, English history and English literature and so forth. And when he was naming me, he was trying to decide between a king and a prime minister, and I was in danger of being Neville Takei, which I would never. Thank God my father went the kingly route.
Now, when you pronounce it, you say Takei.
Takei, right.
Okay, so there's a definite accent on the second syllable.
Yes, and it's K, not Kai, as
right.
Most people want to pronounce it. You know, they want to give it the Germanic EI.
Uh-huh.
But if you speak Spanish or any of the Mediterranean languages, E is given the E sound. And I is given the E sound, Takei.
During World War II, did you become at all involved in the internment?
I was a little baby.
Process.
I was born in 40,
uh-huh.
And so I was a tiny little baby. But yes, I did spend my boyhood in those camps. I was born here in Los Angeles, And relocation, as they call it, happened almost immediately. We were initially put in a temporary area, a camp, created temporarily at the racetracks at Santa Anita here. And from there, we were taken to a camp in the swamps of Arkansas, rural Arkansas. And it was there that my mother did a bold and extraordinary thing. She renounced her citizenship. My uncle, on the one hand, volunteered to fight in the United States Army, and my mother felt here she was taking her children behind barbed wires with American soldiers, the country of which she's a citizen, pointing rifles at us and taking her children behind barbed wire, not knowing whether we're going to be there for the next 3 months or for the rest of our lives. Is she condemning, you know, her children to living behind barbed wire like criminals for that length of time, or whatever length of time?
Did all of that happen when you were too young to really have formed any attitudes about it?
Well, I was very, very young. So, you know, for me, it was, my parents told us we were going for a long vacation in the country. And I was, you know, actually my real memories, you know, tromping through the swamp, was good fun for a kid. But I do remember the tension and the anxiety with each of the moves and the women crying. And I remember, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and my parents and a few of their friends, you know, with a tiny little light on in the corner, talking, and my mother would be crying. And I guess that's when she was discussing the renunciation of her citizenship. And my father tried to talk her out of that, but he said that, you know, she was a willful woman, couldn't control her then, and couldn't control, you know. Anyway, she went through with that. And because she did renounce her citizenship, she had to, by virtue of that act, by that act, she had to be put in what they called a hardcore camp, which was in Northern California, which meant that the family would have to be separated. My father didn't want that to happen, so he voluntarily, although he retained his citizenship, he voluntarily went with my mother to the hardcore camp, and of course the children went there. I was oblivious of all this, you know, while it was happening, and it wasn't until I was much older that I appreciated the anguish that
there must have been a point at which you had to
through.
Kind of confront maybe some anger within yourself.
Well, this was after the camp, the whole camp thing was over.
Yeah.
And of course, my mother's citizenship was reinstated, because that literally was a decision made with a gun pointed at her, you know, not at her head, but it was pointed at her. And she was reacting to that. And I'm really actually very proud of the way she reacted to that. I think it was a very American reaction to a very un-American act on the part of our government.
Are your parents still living?
My mother's alive. My father passed away in 79. And to meet my mother today, that sweet little old lady, you wouldn't think was that kind of fiery activist that I'm told she was. But I really am proud of that act that she did. As a matter of fact, there was a series of hearings held in the United all across the United States last year.
Yes, I was going to ask you your reaction.
I did testify. As a matter of fact, I have the transcript for that. You might be interested in seeing it. It's not very long. I have it downstairs. Well, I'll get it later.
I can turn this off.
Well, no, we can continue talking. I can retrieve it later. But I did testify at that. And I kind of capsulized essentially what I told you, the fact that I was a child then. And my real memories actually are you know, fond boyhood memories, but it's my understanding of it after that, and my feeling that it was a lesson about our system of government that we learned as a nation, not just, you know, the Japanese Americans in that case were victimized, but in a larger sense, it was the ideals of this country that was most damaged. And unless we learned that lesson from that experience, then we might repeat that again. And that's why we've got to remember, you know, our history with all of its glory as well as its blemishes, and this was one of the darker aspects of American history.
Yeah, well, you just answered my next question, and obviously you're in favor of having this thing threshed out and all, as much information.
Well, I can't. I don't think we really have any choices. Are we going to say we're not in favor of knowing our history?
Yeah.
Are we, going to get a censored history of our country? I mean, that's the most dishonest and ultimately the most destructive thing we can do. I maintain that our system is strong enough and resilient enough, and the ideals are noble enough that we've got to keep it that way. And if once we start censoring it or segregating, the parts that we like and the parts of our history that we don't like, we're going to be in real danger.
You know, this is kind of an odd question to ask in relation to what you're saying, but I just wondered if there are anything about the Star Trek episodes that you look upon now that you see as beginning to date.
Beginning to date, or... I don't think so, no.
We were talking about going back and maybe... How do we regard cultural history of the past? Let's say maybe it might look racist to us or sexist or whatever.
Well, in that respect, perhaps maybe there's a little sexism there. There were two pilots made of Star Trek. The first one didn't quite sell, and a second pilot had to be made in order to sell the series. And one of the reasons why the first pilot didn't sell was the fact that the second in command was not Mr. Spock. Mr. Spock was a much more subordinate character. There was a female character named Number One, played by Majel Barrett, who eventually wound up playing Nurse Chapel, the blonde, who was as Number One was wearing a black wig, and consensus was that having a woman as second in command was unbelievable, and that we couldn't have
that. Isn't that interesting? Because we're not talking about a period of time not that long ago.
That's right, 1965. Wow. So that's how rapidly our society is changing. But it's also a commentary on Gene Roddenberry. When he put that series together, he was the one that placed that female character as the second in command. And maybe in terms of costume, too, the women were in those miniskirts, I've heard this from my women friends. Well, actually, in Star Trek the Motion Picture, we had a unisex kind of uniform. I didn't like that. I think, there is a difference between men and women, and there should be an appreciation and an acknowledgement of that fact. You know, to dress men and women alike, I think is crazy.
I felt that way about the costumes too in the film. Though I enjoy the storyline and everything, but I don't like to see everybody wearing the exact same thing. I find it bothers me for 2 hours.
It's dehumanizing, isn't it? Vive la différence, whether it's sex or personality differences or taste. I mean, there you are in purple, kind of a velvet lounge outfit, and here I am this and that. I think it's variety, and that's what Star Trek was saying. It's the diversity that makes life interesting and engaging, and the thing is to make that diversity the basis for enjoyment of each other rather than the basis for hate and inability to work with each other, and that should be also expressed in terms of our clothes, our personality, our lifestyle, and to deprive us of that, and even to deprive us of our sexual differences in terms of our clothing expression, as in Star Trek the Motion Picture, I thought was terrible.
But ironically, the one element of that pilot that could be called a liberated or forward-looking thing, the lady in second in command, was the very thing that was put down.
That's right. And in her place, we got pointy-eared Vulcans. So it was liberal and progressive in that respect.
Well, in this respect, can you say maybe that it's fair to assume that the Star Trek series will become almost a cultural artifact of the time from which they came, the '60s? I mean, not necessarily a view of the future, but how we thought about the future in the '60s.
I think so. But also, I think there is a timeless quality about that because it was science fiction, because it wasn't, in terms of dress, rooted in the 60s, the ideas that we toyed with, I think are still pertinent in many respects. The inability for generations to get along with each other, you know, and that at that time that was a burning issue too, you know, the generational divergence in some, you know, the some parents even that killing their progeny, you know, there were some movies made of that, that sort of thing may not happen to that dramatic extreme, but you know that's a perennial issue. The difficulty that generations have to in living with each other and understanding each other, the inability of at that time we may have been dealing specifically with the civil rights crisis, but inability of people to work and live with each other because of superficial physical differences, you know, still exists. Mm-hmm. So I think in that respect, some of the ideas that we dealt with. Will remain universal.
I thought before we moved on into the films, could you give me a very quick a little calendar of dates here? For example, when you began acting in films or television, when you began with the Star Trek series, then how long that lasted, and what films have come along since then?
When I began acting, my mother says I made my theatrical debut in the maternity ward. I've been performing as far back as I can remember, you know, putting on backyard theatricals, grammar school plays I still remember, and I remember going out to see Errol Flynn and Robin Hood and becoming infatuated with that and coming home and having my mother make me the costumes and organizing the neighborhood kids. Oh, it was really...
It's a book I've done on Doug Fairbanks.
Oh, well, what do you know? Oh, we really had an our gang kind of thing. You know, of course, it was my costume. My mother made the costumes, and it was my backyard, so I played Robin Hood. I was a chubby little Japanese boy, you know. So here you had a chubby little Japanese Robin Hood. My maid Marion was Martha Gonzalez. And my Friar Tuck. My Friar Tuck was taller than me and skinnier, Gary McGarry. really was our gang.
Who was the casting director of that?
Oh, project? Me, of course. And I wrote it, and I directed it, and I produced it, and I bossed everybody around. My mother made the costume, and, you know.
And I suppose you went on from there into high school workshops?
High school. Yeah. But, you know, my parents didn't want me to be an actor. And they saw the handwriting on the wall. Not only handwriting, you know, there I was performing at the dinner table now. So they said, well, you're also, you know, interested in architecture, aren't you? And they would subscribe to architectural journals and leave it lying around. And my father would say, you know, there's an interesting building going up downtown. Why don't we go down and look at it? And he would point out things to me and say, so I got the message, you know, and I was a good son. So I started off my college career as an architecture student up at Berkeley. And this was Berkeley in the pre-revolutionary days. We were the panty raid generation.
All right. I remember those.
Oh, we had our values right down to the fundamentals. I mean, we didn't get involved in free speech and baby speech and all that. We organized and marched up to the sorority houses, you know, in huge hordes and said, we want panties. We want panties. And the girls would peek out the second floor window and bring their little lacy things and tease us with it like this, you know. And one bold, venturesome girl would throw it out, and there'd be a great roar that would go out, and 10 zillion arms would reach up and start pulling at it, and I got a shred, I got a ribbon, I got a lace. And then the chant would go up again, we want more panties. Those are my Berkeley days. Before Mario Savio and all that. But I was, you know, an architecture student on paper. I was spending more time in the English department. As a matter of fact, you know, I was a bearded spear carrier in their production of Macbeth.
Well, Robin
hiding behind
spear
a
carriers.
Lot of, you know, beard and hair on the face and all that. And I, you know, I was one of the Scotsmen in the battle sequences of Macbeth there. And I said to myself, this is ridiculous. I've got to be realistic with myself. You know, I'm supposed to be architecture student, but here I am, you know, getting bad grades because, you know, I'm spending all my time masquerading as a Scotsman, carrying spears and all that. And fate also came into play then. I was back in Los Angeles for the summer. My father was in real estate, and one of his associates, a woman, dabbled in theatrical agenting. And at the office, she told my father that they're casting for a Japanese science fiction film that they're importing, and they're wiping out the Japanese dialogue and dubbing in English dialogue.
So that would have been Rodan?
Yes. They were looking for Japanese voices.
Let's see, what date are we talking about on Rodan? 58,
60? 50, it's in the 50s. Okay. 58, thereabouts.
I'll check that 58, 59,
thereabouts.
The picture scared the hell out of me when I first saw it.
Oh, did it really?
I was still young enough that I didn't notice people wearing suits. It looked very real to me.
Well, anyway, my father came home and over the dinner table, he said, George, you haven't got a summer job yet. Mary was talking about this thing here, and so why don't you try out and see if you can, you know, get a summer job. I tried out for it, and I got the second lead, the scientist with the horn-rimmed glasses.
Okay.
And also you do, you know, 10 dozen other voices, the policeman, the honeymooner.
No wonder somebody the voices sound like.
Oh, that is rough work. I didn't realize, you know, because not only do you do the dialogue, but you also do the crowd noises. And they're, you know.
Mumble.
No. They're panic-stricken, shrieking. Ah! Oh! Or the monster's choke. You know, take after take. You know, right on, you know, and it's got to be synced. You know, each time the man jerks, you go, you know, oh, you come home absolutely raw. You know, the throat's just torn to shreds. But I enjoyed it. I was acting, and I was getting paid for it. I was absolutely, you know, swept up by that. And I said to my father, you know, I'm going to have to do something about this. I don't want to, you know, 10 years down the road, after I'm done with architecture and ensconced in some architect's office, you know, sitting at a drafting table, drafting away, being miserable and unhappy and thinking I coulda, I shoulda, I woulda,
take a shot,
you know,
at it, yeah.
And I said, I've got to be honest with myself and at least be fair to myself right now. And I'm going to go to New York and enroll at the Actor's Studio. My father said, I knew this conversation would eventually be coming up. And, you know, he saw the way I was coming home from the dubbing sessions, you know. And so he said, well, your mother and I would like you to at least have that sheet of paper that says you're legitimate, you know. They're into the degree thing. And they don't give those degrees at the Actor's Studio. If you go to UCLA, you want to study theater. Study theater there at UCLA and get that degree. You will be subsidized. If you go to New York, you're going to do it all on your own. And New York is a tough place. And, you know, it's you could call, but, you know, this is the bargain, and you make your decision, and we're not going to waver from that decision. We love you and all, but, you know, you're going to make your decision, and you're going to live with it. And I said, well, Dad, let's compromise. All right, you know, you want me to stay in Los Angeles, and I want to go to New York. The Goodman Theater in Chicago is halfway. Can I have at least half subsidy there? And my father said, the subsidy doesn't cross the Los Angeles County line.
About how old were you then? 18,
I was 19 thereabouts, I guess. Uh-huh. And I was old enough to be practical. You know, having lived at Berkeley, you know, you're away from home, and, you know, you do appreciate the check coming in. I made the practical decision. I went to UCLA. And actually, Father knows best in many respects, because, you know, at that time I was infatuated with just the thought of becoming a movie star, you know. When you study theater, the history of the whole rich history of the theater, the aesthetics of the theater, the other kinds of theater, Greek drama, Elizabethan, you know, it really opened up many, many other doors, and I have that to be grateful, you know, I have my father to thank for opening those doors for me. And I, you know, after I got my bachelor's, I eventually got my master's at it as well, because...
Yeah, we seem to be living in a time when more and more actors have a good sense of theatrical history and development. And that maybe didn't used to be the case, but it
That's
seems
right.
to be now.
Well, I guess it happened at a time when, I mean, you know, an earlier generation, actors just fell into it. You know, you were discovered, and you were put on contract, and so you really didn't, you know, have the opportunity to, if that had happened to me, you know, if I got a term contract at MGM or something, you know, I probably would have stuck with it, and if if the circumstances weren't there to open up my windows, so to speak, you know, I probably would not have discovered those areas. But you know, the age of contracts was over, and we had in between engagements plenty of between engagement time, unemployment, you know, that we wanted to fill, and I found, you know, I wanted to fill it that way by continuing my studies for a degree.
By golly, at this time, between that time and the beginning of Star Trek's not that many years. Things must have begun to happen rather quickly for you.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I kind of acted my way through college. I started at UCLA, and but at the dubbing session, which Mary Reeves got for me, was another man, an agent, who was watching the way I, you know, performed. And he came up to me and said, "I'd like to represent you." I said, "Well, I'm going to, you know, be going to UCLA, and besides, you know, Mary Reeves was one who got me this job, and my father knows her and all that, you know. I'm going to be at UCLA." And so, I just left it at that. But I was seen in a student production at UCLA. By a casting director at Warner Brothers at that time, Hoyt Bowers, who's now at Paramount. Actually, he's got cancer, and he's been out for the last few months. It's kind of sad, because Hoyt's played an important role in my career also. He was the one that saw me in a student production at UCLA, and... called the UCLA office, theater arts department office, the next morning, and said, "You know, you've got this student, George Takei. How can I get in touch with him? You know, would you get a message to him that, you know, Warner Brothers would like to have him call?" And I got that message, called, and they wanted to test me for a movie. And I said, "Well, I better call that agent back. You know, I've heard all those horrible stories about how Hollywood... you know, we'll get you indentured." So anyway, I went and was interviewed, and they liked me, and they but they wanted to test me, because it was this Edna Ferber thing, Ice Palace, a three-generational thing, and I had to age from like 20 to 80 or something like that, you know, and they wanted to, most of my part was while I was young.
You literally saw your whole life pass before your eyes, right?
Not only saw, I felt it. Oh, that makeup was very painful. Anyway, they wanted to make sure that I could credibly look 60 or whatever, you know, age I aged to. And so I had to make makeup tests, and it was really a lot of fun. You know, they would put you in front of the camera and the director would ask you questions, and you'd respond to it, and he would say, "Well, now pretend that you're, you know, such and such age," and respond to it in that way, and so forth. Anyway, apparently I passed muster, because I got cast. My first picture, and here I was in a film starring Richard Burton, Robert Ryan, Carolyn Jones, Martha Heyer, all big stars of that. Yes. And I got a 3-week location trip in Alaska. And this, again, happened to fall during the summertime. So it was my next summer's summer job, you know. Then we shot back at the studio for about 4 months, slopped over into school a little bit. As a matter of fact, I couldn't continue with ROTC because slopped over into, you know, the semester, and I had to quit ROTC, but the theater arts department was understanding, so I was able to straddle both school and work.
Yeah, I had a year of that myself. Were you of draft? I mean, there was a draft.
That's right.
I mean, because I got nailed in 70. Did you ever serve in the service? How did that?
I was taking ROTC so that I could, you know, hold off on that. When I had to drop out of ROTC, I figured I had to, you know, do something to, you know, stay out. So I volunteered for the National Guard, went to take the physical, and I, when I was a child, I had an operation here for a thing called interoception. And shortly after the operation, they sewed me up with the sutures that's supposed to dissolve into my stomach. I got a bad case of cold. I was about, what, a year and a half or whatever. Very, very young. And my stomach didn't have the strength to digest the sutures. And it got rotten and broke up into tiny little pieces. And I had to have an operation on top of the operation to pull out the broken bits of suture. And that operation was one that poked two holes over the scar. It looks like I've got two more belly buttons right here.
I'll be darned.
And under extreme tension or pressure, there's like 1 in 1,000 chance of this bursting. And the National Guard decided they didn't want to take that chance with me. And so they gave me a, not 4F, but, you know, some lower degree.
Are the chances remote enough, though, that, I mean, it's not something you think about?
I mean,
you're so athletic in what you
do. There's really no chance of anything happening, but I guess they just didn't want to take that, and I welcomed that.
Really?
And so, make like Lyndon Johnson.
Good heavens. Take a look. Oh, come on, take a look.
Oh,
he's
Lyndon.
Not kidding. It does look like two actually.
It really does.
Holy mackerel.
These two holes were poked in there to to pull out the broken sutures.
Look at her sitting down here over
yes,
there.
Well, you know, in junior high school, during boys' gym, every semester, when you know, we'd have to shower, to have to explain what these two were. I got so tired of going through that story, I told people, you know, I was just attached to my mother. Very attached to my mother.
Well, now we're at Ice Palace, and we still haven't gotten to Star Trek. How much do we have to cover between
Well,
those
Star
two?
Trek came after I graduated, and I'd gotten my master's, too, for that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked my way through college. I did a whole slew of Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers liked my work on Ice Palace, and
what are some of the other films that you're talking about here? What are some other titles?
I did about a half a dozen Hawaiian Eyes. I did a Maverick, playing a Chinese gold miner. I did Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip, you know, all those, you know, the series that they ground out. They had about a dozen different series going.
Oh God, Sugarfoot and
yeah,
Follow the Sun and Bourbon Street Beat.
I did Follow the Sun too. The Follow the Sun wasn't Warner Brothers though. Follow the Sun was 20th, but it's the same, you know, genre.
Troy Donahue.
Troy Donahue, Diane McBain, Cookie Burns. Jim Garner was about the only one that survived that period.
That's right.
Bob Conrad, Tony Isley, Connie Stevens, you know, the whole lot there. So I did a whole slew of those. I did, you know, Californians, Adventures in Paradise.
Oh, I remember that.
Oh, do you remember that?
Yes.
There was another one like Adventures in Paradise.
I even remember the theme song to that.
Oh, do you?
Da, 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 da.
Oh, yeah, very good. You're a true buff. Gardner McKay,
yeah.
Who's now a drama critic here in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
Mm. There was another one like
Richard
The
Long
Islanders.
Passed on.
That was the MGM version of Adventures in Paradise. So all those, you know. When I graduated, when I got my bachelor's degree, my father did a very sweet thing, very symbolic. My father likes to deal in symbols, you know. He was the one that was resistant to my studying theater and you know, becoming an actor and all. But when I finally got the bachelor's degree, I was rather touched by that.
Really?
I thought it was...
I would have taken that, I'm sure. So lots of television work. Did that kind of background then profit you when it came time for Star Trek? Can you see that as an advantage?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
For example, what are some of the things, what are some of the ropes that you felt that you learned in the early TV series before you got to Star Trek?
Well, television, you know, my acting at the university was stage. And there's a whole, it's a whole different way of working between the stage and television altogether. I learned very early on that if you act as you do for the stage, particularly at Royce Hall at UCLA, when you're projecting out, you know, and you're doing Cyrano and those great grand classics, if you act that way in front of the camera, you know, that you're going to be the hammiest thing around. So you learn very quickly to, you know, restrain yourself. Also, acting for the camera is very, very technical. You know, you have to know where the key lights are. You could be doing these beautiful things, but if you're, you know, not in the light, or if you're not on your mark, you know, it's lost. Whereas,
you know, I think sometimes we think of the director, the cameraman, as taking care of that. But that's right. If the actor doesn't know what's happening,
absolutely,
a lot of that can get lost, huh?
You know, there's. This was something I heard on TV, an interview with Peter O'Toole. He always gets to me. O'Toole, you know. In Beckett,
yeah,
or whatever, you know, he has a way of really grabbing your heart. And I always thought that it was because he was so into the role, so, you know, had personalized that character. I was absolutely shattered to hear him discuss his role in Beckett or A Lion in Winter. He says, whenever you want to reach an audience and to get their sympathy, just find your key light, lower the body, and look up.
Hmm.
Look up. If you have that, you know, looking up toward God kind of look, it works every time. And, you know, I'd catch on the Late Show, or, you know, on the Sunday afternoon show, Beckett or Lion in Winter. And sure enough, you know, if you look at it very coldly and mechanically, he is doing it all very by the numbers. And it works. You know, but you have to find your key light and then pick up the glint in your eyes just the right way, you know.
Well, that sense of calculation, we don't often think of that, but sure, it's got to be there.
Oh, no, it's not just that, of course, obviously. I mean, it's a rich, rich performance that he surrounds that looking up in.
Well, Barrymore had a habit of doing that.
That's right, that's
looking
right.
Looking up through beetled brows or something like that. And so did Byron. I mean, good heavens, we can go all the way back with that.
But motion picture acting is, well, every acting is technical, and you have to adjust to it. You know, on the stage, just feeling the role inside isn't going to do it. If you're working in Royce Hall or the Ebell Theater here, you've got to project out. If you can't be heard, then, you know, your performance is not communicating to the audience.
How about your performances in this series? Do you feel that... as a character, you had the opportunities to develop, that you had enough to do?
No.
Episode
to episode? No, absolutely not. We were constantly lobbying, you know, but when you have, what, six or seven regulars and you're the fifth banana, you know, and particularly if you have two leads that are always kind of jockeying with each other, you know, the opportunities for the fifth banana is extremely limited. I would, you know, send memos to Gene Roddenberry saying, oh, there's an opportunity to do this, and Sulu is such a rich and wonderful character. He could have, you know, this sort of thing and that. And I would expect to see that in the script the next week, you know. And it's the same thing. If anything, you know, Spock is more important than he was in the first script, or the captain has 10 zillion more scenes added to him, you know. And it's very frustrating working like that.
Are there at least, though, some episodes that you especially fondly recall?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There are episodes where, you know, at least once a year you get to your chance to come out of the shadows just for a few fleeting moments. Then you're plunged back into the shadows again.
Well, now, for example, next time I have the set on and the series is on, what episodes would I watch for that I would know you?
Well, Naked Time gave me a chance to do, you know, a little bit more than just press buttons. I got to run around with a fencing foil and look a little crazed. And in fact, every one of the scenes where, you know, I get something to do, I'm frenzied or crazed or zapped out. Another one that I'm that gave me something more to do was Mirror Mirror, where we played the mirror, the reverse of our characters. You know. Sulu is a wonderful, lovable person as we know him on the series, but in Mirror Mirror we see the reverse of that, mm-hmm. The cutthroat, vicious, avaricious, ambitious, murderous kind of character. And it was wonderful to, you know, be able to stretch and play something
There's no contact, is there, between that and Mirror Friend, Mirror Foe? I've not read Mirror Friend, Mirror Foe, so I don't know. Is one a spin-off of the other, or
no,
are they two different
things? No, they're two totally different things, but it was not coincidental. It was not uncalculated.
You were looking up into that key light again.
The literary key light, yes. Right.
Well, I hope we can maybe get into that in a bit, but we've got to get to the films. I did want to remind you that what we have on tape here won't be print until
I trust
early
you will
August.
Be very judicious also.
And I will transcribe this myself and all of that kind of thing. In fact, Stacy is the only person that will be hearing any of this.
Well,
she's already forgotten. Who,
and I know that you're going to be a good journalist and correct my grammar. And
so anyway, all of that having been said, I is Spock going to die? Can you tell me that?
Oh, because it's going to be printed after the movie's out.
Yeah.
Yes, he dies. Frankly, well, now this is off the record, okay? Spock's dying was a condition of Leonard's coming back. Everybody with the studio and Gene Roddenberry resisted that idea. They said, you know, why kill off a character that's so rich? And whether you play it or not, you know, leave the character alive so that you could maybe have second thoughts and we can bring the character back. Don't kill him off. But he insisted that the character be killed. If he's not going to be killed, he won't be back. That was a condition of his being back. However, and so they finally accommodated him and wrote the script that way. However, after the great groundswell of opposition to that notion, Leonard's decided now that that wasn't his idea, and he's...
It's a fait accompli, but he's disavowing
any responsibility for the genesis of that notion, of, the genesis of the death.
Oh, well. And what's this I hear?
I trust you're correct. Well, this part is all off the record, so, you know, but
now,
my syntax and my metaphors frequently get all jumbled up.
Well, so what does this mean with relation to any possible future Star Trek episodes, either on film or television? I mean, is somebody going to find a way to bring him back from the grave with another character?
In science fiction, anything
can really
happen.
Well, I mean, you remember the way Empire Strikes Back ended. With
well,
Ford, so.
Watch this ending very carefully, however. Watch it. Because I think Leonard is going to start growling, oh, those damn bastards. You know, do you remember? Another plot element.
Yeah, let's talk about the plot.
The creation of this genesis factor, this energy burst that creates life. And that's been exploded off in the galaxies. And the missile, the torpedo bearing Spock's dead body that's been jettisoned from the ship goes off in the direction of the Genesis clouds.
Even Spock's looking for his key light, right?
There's no, Spock, Leonard isn't aware of that. I mean, you know. Oh,
really?
There's no thing made of it in the script. I happened to be chatting with Harv Bennett, and Harv said, well, the torpedo did go off in the direction of this.
I love it.
This Genesis explosion, you know, with this burst of energy off in that part of the galaxy. There's no point made of it, but if they choose to put two and two together in a subsequent episode, that's entirely within the realm of possibility. Watch, when you see the film, watch the ending very carefully.
Now, how much is yet to be done on that film? Is everything in the can? Editing,
the principal photography is done.
Okay.
And as I understand it, they've got a rough cut. I haven't seen it. But Bob, the associate producer, said to me that he saw a rough cut of it, and they're very pleased.
Will you be given the opportunity to see it as soon as anything?
That's what we're told. Yes.
Yeah. In fact, we saw the. They don't keep you in the dark about anything.
No, they put together a trailer for the. Theater owners, and I got a chance to take a peek at that, and the trailers are absolutely sensational. They really do sweep you off.
Let's talk about this in the other film. Same uniforms?
No, different uniforms. Or
different again.
It's quite, the whole film this time around is quite different from Star Trek, the motion picture. For one thing, it's got pace and rhythm and a genuine conflict, and it's high adventure. It's a real clash of will, and there's tension, and there's drama, and we get into space battles, and the Enterprise
well,
bridge.
Well, who are the villains
absolutely
in this? See, I don't know anything about the plot of this.
Did you see? Do you recall the episode Space Seed? Ricardo Montalban.
Oh, of course he's in this. Okay, all right.
It's the same character.
What are you getting at? All right.
It's the same character. He was abandoned on this planet with these barbarian types, and he comes back and takes over another ship in Starfleet, and that's where the battle comes in. You know, he starts firing at us,
right.
we're firing back at him, and Montalban is a wonderful adversary. You know, the problem with Star Trek the motion picture was there was no real pitting of forces.
Right.
V'ger was too awesome, too all
such a heavy
powerful,
mystical,
omniscient and omnipotent. You know, if there should have been any conflict, the Enterprise would have been wiped out just like that. You know, I mean, V'ger was just too omnipotent. All we could do was just be awed by it. You know, with gripping, rolling eyes, look out the window.
Sort of like.
So, you know, where's the conflict? Where's the drama with that sort of situation? It got philosophically a little kind of wafty there, you know. Whereas here, there isn't that much attempt at philosophizing, but there's good, rip-roaring drama, you know. And Montalban is a powerful adversary, cunning adversary, and a ruthless adversary. And, you know, Kirk is really put on guard.
Is there anything involved in this in terms of the crew getting together or coming back to the ship? I mean, all that was done in the first film, right? So we don't have to go through all of that sort of thing.
We're assumed to, you know, be... Well, as a matter of fact, there is an examination of the passage of time, and we're all going off to different things. This is my... is Sulu's one last final service on the Enterprise. And there's a brief discussion of, you know, Kirk congratulating me on getting my own ship. I'm going to go off and be the captain of my own ship, but I come back for just this one go round.
Does this reflect a real situation? Is it the last voyage for you?
We'll see. We'll see. If somebody that gets killed off can get shot off, his carcass can get shot off in a life-giving, into a life-giving cloud, there's certainly something to be done with a helmsman who's become a captain of his own ship going off. Maybe I'll come back the adversary and right. start shooting at the Enterprise.
How about
zapped out, you know.
How about the bridge sets and things like that? Is there anything carried over from the first film?
It's the same same set from the film. The sets have not been changed at all appreciably. However, in the Star Trek the Motion Picture, many of the buttons were practical. You know, you'd punch a button and something would light up or mm-hmm. things would start moving. Whereas I noticed that on this go-round, that wasn't so. It was all operated by the special effects man. And my gear shift has been eliminated. Do you remember the gear shift that I had? Wise wanted, you know, because there was no opportunity for tension, you know, the V'ger thing was so, you know, big and wafty. The only opportunity that we had to show tension was, you know, I had my short sleeve shirt on and my arm pressing that up and the muscles would, you know, tense
up. What method acting is that?
That was about the only kind of tension we got, on Star Trek, the motion pictures, and he wanted to see, you know, that sort of thing. In this one, I just press a button.
What is this I'm hearing about explosions on the bridge?
Oh, absolutely. I did my own stunts as well.
That involves you flying around the
air?
Well,
you know, the other Reliant, USS Reliant, is shooting at us, and we take one big major hit, and we had a lot of stuntmen, you know, fly around. But I think it's always fun to do it yourself. And that way you get the camera on you too. You know, it's not just somebody's back going up. That's supposed to be me. You know, the camera's right off the face. And when I take the hit, the explosion's right here. And you know, they were gonna shoot it this way, but the camera is over here, and I'm sitting at the console looking up like that, and thing goes off, and I have a little spring type thing, you know, so I just bounce off that. And there's a whole pile of mattresses off to the side mm-hmm. that I fly into. It's, you know, it's no big deal. I mean, it's, you know, just throwing the body off. And
well, it must be odd any time you shoot scenes in which the ship is hit by something or there's vibration. I was on the set the day you were shooting a scene on the first film when there was a guy at the rear of the set with a pole, with a disc on top of the pole. And as you, all of you spoke, you were supposed to be shaking and then following this disc.
That's the
as it moved around.
Was that the wormhole sequence?
Yes.
Ah,
yes.
Oh, that was
doggone
2 weeks
thing to
of
watch.
Agony and anguish.
You know, we're supposed, I mean, all of you were going like
you. You know, they had the special effect thing, and it was on the screen for no more than what, about 3 minutes,
yeah.
3 or 4 minutes. We
not
took
even that
2 weeks to shoot that. And the moment that the director said, you know, action, we'd have to start going like this, you know, it was this jouncing thing, you know. It was so exhausting.
And I was watching this out of context. I didn't know what
you
the
come
world.
Home from, you know, when you're doing this all day long. I came home and worked so exhausted. You know, I usually take a shower, but I would flop into a tub, you know, because it was so exhausting. The funny thing is, you know, it's like Pavlov's dog. You know, for 2 weeks when the director says action and you respond like this, when we were done with that scene and Bob Wise would say action, I felt like going like that. Oh, that was a god-awful sequence. God-awful. No, we had no sequences like that on this. We had just explosions going off, you know, and bodies
flying.
Well,
you know, there's this German film out now called Das Boot.
Boot. Yeah, I've heard about it.
Yeah, I saw it in New York recently.
Oh, you did? I hear it's very good.
Short voyage to the bottom of the sea. I've never seen a submarine take so much punishment. And it's all of this eternal vibration going back and forth. But anyway, so at least you're spared that this time around.
This sort of thing, yes. It's just bodies flying, you know, leaping off of springy seats.
Now, a friend of mine, Dick Keenan, he was doing a journal on the set of Star Trek, the motion picture. You may have seen him sitting back there with Wise a lot. He made the comment that...
What time is it? Ooh, well, let's go up and...
Yeah, conclude this after the...
We will conclude
after
this
after the program.
The theater buff.
I know Fuseli did a bunch of Shakespearean scenes. What is this? Is part of a specific artist series or something?
Mm-mm. They're just... They all date to the early 1800s. These are too. But I don't know who the artists are.
That might be Fuseli.
Oh, really?
Because that's those are his dates. Fuseli.
Well, it may be. I don't know.
He was one of the early romantics with Jericho.
Oh, Jericho.
This is Benjamin West. All right.
You're kidding.
An American painter who also was the president of the Royal Academy.
Is it Benjamin West?
Mm-hmm.
You're kidding.
This engraving after Benjamin West. There, president of the Royal Academy.
I never really did.
What That's did one of the most fascinating stories in art history. How an American painter ended up president of the Royal Academy.
Engraved by...
Francis Lagat.
I can't...
L-A-G-A-T.
Lagat.
I didn't know West did anything like this.
Where does it say Benjamin West?
Right there. R.A.
Benjamin West. Well, what do you know? I really should examine these a little bit better. This is... I can't read.
That's a guy named Howard. What,
Why something? West, W-Y?
Westall. Now, F is usually an S. Yeah, W-E-S-T-A-L-L. I've never heard of him.
Hmm. Oh, but that's Benjamin West, is it?
Yes, sir.
Well, what do you think?
R.K. Porter.
This was a profitable visit. I found out something of my collection that I hadn't noticed before.
So did I. I didn't know West did anything like this. You know, West was always doing this Death of a Pale Horse stuff. Death of Wolf.
Hmm.
Death doing this and that. Beth was quite active in the West.
Would you like more wine rather than, more beer rather than wine?
No, this is fine. This is fine. The last thing we were talking about, my friend Dick Keenan, who was a journalist and was on the set during most of the Paramount stage shooting, said that it looked to him as if Gene Roddenberry, although he was there a lot, frankly, didn't have a whole lot to do.
Star Trek, the motion picture?
The first one, yeah. That leads to several questions. One, do you think that there's any truth in that? Did he maybe feel a bit excluded from the experience of the first film? And is he even more excluded in the second film?
Well, Gene had some difficulties with the first film. I guess we can talk about it now. Or I don't know to what extent I can, but as you know, we had enormous cost overruns.
Yeah.
And with each incremental... thank you. Overrun. Yes, help yourself, please. More authority was lost by him until, it gone so far up, the cost had gone so far beyond the initial budget that Gene, for all rights and purposes, was powerless.
Mm-hmm.
The power is all reverted to the money source. The front office. That was one of the factors that caused a problem. Another one was that they made decisions that locked the production in without really consulting the creative people. For example, the premiere date was contractually locked in when the producers and the creators said, "We can't do it." They were contractually committed to delivering a film, a finished film, on a certain date. And so, by hook or by crook, whether it was ready or not, they shoehorned, something into that post-production period and came up with a film that obviously was not quite ready for public viewing. In the second one, the current one, Star Trek II, Gene is on board as a consultant. But a consultant with no veto power.
Aha.
So he can write memos, he can make recommendations, give advice, and they would say thank you and merrily go ahead and do what they were doing. So it's been a very frustrating situation for Gene in both situations, but particularly with the most recent one, I would think that to a creative person like Gene, to a man who has so much ideas, so many ideas, and to a man who really is the greatest authority on Star Trek, it's his baby, he created it. And he's obviously got, you know, a great deal of knowledge about the context in which the show should be appearing. It can be very frustrating to not be able to make meaningful contributions to it.
There seems to have been a difference of opinion, too, in the ways in which the first Star Trek film related back to some of the plot lines in the TV episodes.
For example?
The way V'ger... You know, the appearance of V'ger. Apparently, now I don't know, I can't name specific episodes, but I know buffs who can, who'll say, well, this element came from this episode, and here's this other episode that dealt with
discovery
of a V'ger type thing. I don't know, Stacey, do you know any of those specific titles?
Not the titles.
But there's at least two that I hear referred to a lot. And a lot of people say, this wasn't such a great idea. Why couldn't we have had an original script or whatever? Now, has all of that problem been circumvented in the second one? Is it original stuff all the way, or are there references?
No, it's the sequel to Space Seed. You know, there are characters that are carryovers from that episode. However, there are many inconsistencies that I'm sure the true buffs could point out. For example, Chekhov. Was a character that was introduced the second season of Star Trek. There was no Chekhov on the Enterprise the first season. However, Space Seed is a first season show. And yet, when Chekhov sees Khan, he recognizes him. So, there are little discrepancies like that that I'm sure Star Trek fans would be able to point out.
I still don't understand, then. Is this kind of a revised version of this episode, or does it extend from it and carry it on through into a different realm?
It's a continuation of that plot.
Okay.
The same character.
It's not a retelling of it.
No. We pick up where that character was left off 10 years later.
In fact, I've heard that the working title of the film at this point is something like Revenge of Khan or like that. Nothing?
There is a subtitle, but it's not that. It's a Shakespearean quote. The undiscovered country, from whose bourne no traveler returns, puzzles the will and rather makes us bear those ills and fly to others that
now
we know not
of. That's either Hamlet
or
Hamlet.
It's Hamlet.
Huh. And as far as you know, that's
the undiscovered country.
So when they say Star Trek II... On Entertainment
Star Trek
II,
The
like
Undiscovered Country.
Okay. Do you think a lot of people are going to see that as a science fiction film, The Undiscovered Country? I'm a great believer in titles sometimes having an impact on an audience.
I think that the operative title, obviously, is Star Trek II.
I wonder if Undiscovered Country might get deleted entirely after a point.
It may. I don't know.
Let's see. I'm supposed to ask you if Khan is real or is he an android?
He's real, yes. That android thing comes from Time magazine. They had a shot of Ricardo Montalban and three female barbarians with him.
Sounds good.
And yes, it's there. Montalban is fantastic. He's in his 60s. I think he's about 64 or 65. He is in incredible shape. You know, on Fantasy Island, he's wearing that suit, so you really can't tell. Yeah. But in this one, he's bare-chested through a good portion of it. And the first few days, the crew people kept saying, boy, get a load of Ricardo's tits. I mean, his pectoral muscles, you know, I mean, so well-defined, as if it's almost drawn on. Great, fantastic muscles. It really, you know, kind of makes you think it can be done. You can be 60 and look like that.
I take it from what you've been saying so far that maybe I detect a preference to this film as opposed to the first one in your own mind.
No, actually, I enjoyed the first one very much too, although, you know, it wasn't popularly received by the critics. I thought, you know, some of the ideas, the metaphors that they were playing with was intriguing and really quite well done. The metaphor was sexual.
No kidding.
You know, the ideas that they were toying with was man's relationship with highly sophisticated forms of technology, you know. And man is an intellectual creature, a curious creature, but also a very sexual creature. And so the sexual metaphor kept popping up in relationship to, you know, man versus technology throughout the film. First, there's, you know, Kirk's relationship with the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
When he first sees the Enterprise, you know, it's a love scene, a love song that's played, you know, as he circles this voluptuous mistress of his that, you know, I mean, he may have had many human female mistresses and sexual liaisons, but, you know, his real mistress is the Enterprise. So there's that thing that happens early on. And then V'ger, this great, complicated, sophisticated technology, is represented by, personified by Ilea, you know, who is really the product of technology. And she has that relationship going with a human, Decker. There's Enterprise's relationship with V'ger itself. And there, I think the sexual metaphor is very, very prominent there, the throbbing orifices that the Enterprise...
Well, the very final shot, remember?
That's right.
It's like an expulsion or...
Well, you know, the penetration of the and the liquid, voluptuous space that we go through. And then, as you say, the climax that's reached, you know, when the man and the female representative merge in that hair-raising union, you know, yeah. Which presumably gives... birth to another life form.
You studied theater history. You know about Strindberg's concept of the homme femme.
That's right.
I mean, the whole androgynous ideal is somehow carried
through.
So
I thought it was a fascinating film for those sex-oriented people. It's galactic pornography, porno film.
Well, let's take that as a taking-off point, then. As far as the second film is concerned, is it maybe more oriented toward action and incident as opposed to the ideas of the first one? I mean,
it's action adventure. It's high adventure. There's great tension, great conflict, great collision of two opposing and powerful forces, and it's wonderful action adventure.
How about the importance of the special effects relating to both pictures? It was awfully important in the first picture. And I'm wondering if at times you may have seemed a little dwarfed by it all.
Oh, indeed we were.
Is that different in the second one?
You know, this Genesis
character.
Thing that I made reference to, that part requires some specialized special effects. And I see it in my mind's eye. You know, we haven't seen the special effects yet, the Genesis effect taking place. And if they do it well, those effects can be very, very impressive, I think.
But, you know, the irony was that it was never special effects that made Star Trek as popular as it was.
That's right. On television, we really couldn't afford that many special effects.
And,
Transporting On was about the extent of it, you know.
Or hopefully the doors open at the right time. But the second picture, as you describe it, it sounds maybe more of a return to the character and incident that made Star Trek so strong in the first place. Unless
character.
That's an unfair simplification. The sense of all of your characters coming to the fore instead of the special effects coming to the fore.
Yeah, I guess there's more of that in Star Trek 2 than in Star Trek 1.
Mm-hmm.
The character elements do come into play, and it's a much faster-paced, more active film than Star Trek, the motion picture.
How much do the scriptwriters listen to you if you want to suggest some of your own lines? I mean, you know your character now far better than anybody else does.
I'd like to think so, and I made a lot of recommendations, you know, before.
No, I understand. Wise was very sympathetic to recommendations from people. How about Meyer, or the scriptwriter?
Well, in this case, my memos went to Harv Bennett. Mm-hmm. It resulted in only just one short, brief scene that gave Sulu something to do.
What's that?
Of course, all my recommendations were all, they all revolved around Sulu.
Which scene is that? I watched that.
It's the scene in the shuttlecraft. Okay. When you see the film, there's only one scene in the shuttlecraft, and that was something that came as a result of my recommendations, but actually my recommendations, if they had fully followed it through, would have been a rich, powerful, important, dramatically
sounds pretty persuasive to me.
Yeah, when on the screen it's just a, you know, fly over, and they talk about I'll have some more. Kirk congratulates me on my new command assignment, but in my memo it was much better.
Well, okay. When you have been to the conventions or when people talk with you for magazines or whatever, what are some of the questions that you are most often asked and would rather just do away with completely? Which
well,
is to say there's a corollary.
It's
to
very
that.
Undiplomatic for me to
about?
Respond to that honestly, because you, that was one of the questions you've asked.
The one, which one
What's
are
my
you
favorite
most
episode? It's not very diplomatic of me to say that, is it? Because you did ask that.
Yeah,
but you
fell into my own
you,
trap.
Yeah, that's right. You painted yourself into that one.
Yeah. when the fans though come up to you at the conventions, what do they want to know about most?
What's my favorite episode?
This is a nightmare. We keep coming back to point one.
No,
here.
There are others that pass me their keys. And I look at them, I said, really, do I want to use that key?
Star Trek groupies, am I hearing this correctly?
Believe it or not.
Well, I'd love to talk about this, but I don't suppose you will.
Well, try me.
Well, I mean, how brazen does this sort of thing get from the
well, I mean,
Trekkie?
That's pretty obvious when they give you a key with a little note attached to
it. I mean, but then do they become insistent about it later, or do they get back in touch? Or, I mean, what are we
there
talking
are some about? That, you know, you follow through on, and others you just soon if they, you know, hadn't done that because they'd be, you know, I mean.
Well, we think about that sort of thing with rock artists and stuff. But I guess I'd never thought about it in association with a Star Trek convention, but why not? Do people tend to wear those things
some
like
of those
badges?
Fan letters that we get, you know.
I mean, I'd be a little chary if you had
I'm
run into
I'm awfully that. Chary of passionate fan letters because when, and usually they come unaccompanied by a photograph. And if you saw the photograph, you know, would say, thank God it's only a letter. And that's why it's so awkward, you know, at a convention, you know, when this female, you know, personally hands you a note with her keys there, you know.
Well, for one thing, you're on the spot. I mean, what
yes.
are you supposed to
I
do?
I mean, you know, you
want to
be a gentleman.
But at the same time, if you want to say no, I mean, how do you...
You just say
diplomatic?
It's, you know, the convention organizers have packed a full schedule for me, you know, and it's going to be very, very difficult. I'd love to, you know. I just may be there, you know. I'll knock like this. And then you'll know it's me.
It's just, I somehow get this image, George, down in Houston of the hotel corridors late at night with all of this Star Trek crew crossing corridors.
That's a thought.
Wouldn't that make a great episode?
To get a little seven or eight-year-old kid and send him to that door there to knock this way.
Oh, wow. Well, that's one aspect of the conventions. Now, another aspect, I suppose. Another thing would be those people
this
who
This sure ain't a Dick Cavett conversation, is it?
But the other aspect might be, there might be people who come to those things who want to intellectualize everything about Star Trek, you know, all of the profundities implicit in the plots and on and on and on. How do you handle that?
They're there too. Well, it all depends, because there are some really interesting people there, people with exciting ideas. As a matter of fact, my book, Mirror Friend, Mirror Foe, found its genesis in one of those dead dog parties after the convention was over. This was a convention in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. Mm-hmm. After the convention, the members of the committee and a few of the actors were, you know, sitting around drinking and jawing. And I started talking about my ninjas, if you're familiar with what they are. They're a sub-samurai group, people that in Japan, old Japan, who were engaged for the darker, more surreptitious kinds of work. You know, the samurais with warriors, and they were the glamour people.
Like the 47 Ronin.
That's right. Japan, yeah. But the ninjas were hired for sabotage, for espionage, for assassinations, you know, the kind of thing that a noble samurai would not take on. And you know, out of this conversation, the idea came for a collaboration on a novel, a science fiction novel incorporating ninja ideas. And so, you know, you do come across some interesting people that you want to carry on correspondence with later on, you know, after the initial meeting. And that's what I enjoy about these conventions. It's an opportunity really just by serendipity or whatever, meet some people that you probably would not have met otherwise. Interesting people, people with ideas, people that are... Star Trek also attracted a lot of activists, people who did things, you know. And I think that's what Star Trek is all about, to encourage people to take an active role in shaping not only your own life, but the course of human events. If you will.
By the time people are reading this, the film will will have been out.
I know. Excuse when you eat nuts, it's disastrous for conversation.
The film will have been out more than a month, I guess. What, in your opinion? Of course, you haven't seen the final print yet, so I can't really ask you that. I guess I was wanting to know what you're most proud of about that film, and as we watch it, what could we look for that represents what you?
Yeah,
really
I better not
with?
Comment because the thing that I'm most proud of might wind up on the cutting room floor, the proverbial one, you know, and so people will be looking for it in the film, you know, after reading about it, and not find it at all.
I'll tell you what, George, just wind up with this then.
Yes, that shuttlecraft scene may not appear, right. So you may not be able to use that.
How about a John Wayne story? Now you were in Green Berets. Anything about John Wayne that we can close out with? What was it like working with the Duke? Was it kind of intimidating or just all in a day's work?
He is John Wayne, that John Wayne image that we all know. He's very much that off screen as well. And of course, in the Green Berets, that was a Bat Jack production, a John Wayne production. He was the director. The script that we had was thrown out, and he was making up, you know, improvising the script as we went along. And so he was the writer as well, you know. So he wasn't just a star of the film. It was really a John Wayne production all through and through. He had a very John Wayne way of directing. You know, he would say, all right, George, you go over there, and I'll walk here, and I'll say this, and then, George, you say that, and then Aldo over there will say such and such and bring that chair from there to here. And, no, George, not over there. And he'll grab me by the cuff and lift me up and place me right here. Okay, and then I'll go there. You know, he doesn't mean that as being rude or anything. It's just, you know, no, not there, over here. And he'll place you there, and I'll say, yes, sir. very John Wayne, you know, and he'll make up the dialogue, and that's why we spoke like John Wayne throughout, you know, his...
You were kind of his counterpart in a way.
That's right. I was, as he said, the good Vietnamese.
Yeah. And when I showed that to a class, I was astonished. I had never seen it before at how much of a John Ford Western it really is.
That's right. He was very much impressed by Ford.
Yeah.
Oh, you teach a class on film.
Kansas.
On film.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
And we were all set to regard the film in a number of ways, more in terms of propaganda and all of this. But We ended up looking at it as a Western. I mean, Dodge City is even the name of the king. I mean, it was unbelievable. And Wayne's training with Ford. What, Ford actually worked with him on the Alamos?
That's right, that's sure. right. As a matter of fact, on that film, we had... Now, I don't know what the studio politics on that was, but midway through, we were shooting off at Fort Benning in Georgia, far away from the studio. And and we had all sorts of difficulties. We had rain that wasn't expected, and so we had to rewrite the script for rain. And after we rewrote the script for rain, the rain promptly stopped.
Yeah.
And so we had to, you know, muddy down the field, you know, before the sun blazing down, and they would hose down the field, and we'd all have to take shower baths, you know, they would dump us with buckets of water to get us wet again. And they'd be standing with hose, you know, off camera to simulate rain. We had about 2 weeks of rain, and we sat around not shooting for about a week. And then we switched to, you know, to the rain shots, and it promptly stopped, so we had to, you know... Anyway, about halfway through this, Mervyn LeRoy came on the set, sent by the studio. But, you know, Mervyn's a sweet, dear person, and he just, you know, would show up about 10 o'clock in the morning and fold his arms with his cigar, and he would smile and nod and visit with everybody. And